Blog Talk Radio.
It's too young to be on that bridge. It's too young to be sitting on the edge. Too young to be lonely. You're too young.
Welcome to the Healthy Baby Boomers Network Blog Talk Radio Show. I am your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, spiritual relationship healing expert, helping men and women heal their bodies, their relationships, and their lives through love. Author of the popular book, Love Me, Touch Me, Heal Me, and the sexy romantic novel, Love in the Blizzard of Life, available at Amazon.com, and director of HealthyBabyBoomersNetwork.com. This show is all about living your dreams, fulfilling your life purpose, and creating and sustaining love and health and total well-being for the rest of your life, no matter how old you are right now. In every episode, I speak with vibrant, exciting, and positive men and women who are proving that life can, and often does, get better and better as we reach our 40s, 50s, 60s, and beyond, and even starting much younger. I think you will find today's topic titillating, fun, and hopefully educational. On this show, we will be talking all about sex and sexuality. Having received my doctorate in human sexuality, marriage, and family living in the 1980s, I have observed many changes in our sexual attitudes, expectations, and behaviors. Miss M, advice columnist for the New York Sex Museum, invited me to participate in a special panel exclusively for members of Soho Beach House in Miami, a community of members from fashion, media, literature, publishing, movies, TV, music, art, and more, on the evening of February 10th. So I'm excited to have this opportunity to be speaking directly with Ms. M and to share our unique perspectives on sexuality in 2014. Ms. M, writer and advice columnist for the Museum of Sex in New York City, that many of you never realized existed, specializes in helping individuals and couples with relationship and sexual development. Her article, The Internal Clitoris, has garnered attention from numerous media outlets, including a special IO9, 10-9 News, not sure of that, Huffington Post, and Andrew Sullivan from The Daily Beast, as well as having been translated into 6 languages. Additionally, she works with universities, parents, and educators to develop innovative new ways to educate teens and students about sex and sexuality. She also has a master's degree in music, sings opera, plays oboe, and scores for film and television. Her upcoming book, Orgasm Diaries, is due out this summer. She lives in Manhattan with her fiancé and their rescued dog and a Bengal cat. So I'm so delighted to welcome you, Ms. M.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
And what was that news station? I don't think I got it right.
It's IO9 News.
Oh, it is IO9 News. I had never heard of that. Well, welcome. And
thank you.
So I would love you to tell us a little bit about your background and how you got to be involved in this as an advice columnist for this New York Sex Museum.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting how life events sort of bring you to where you're destined to be. But I come from a long line of sexually confident women, from my great-grandma to my mom. So discussing things of the sexual nature is perfectly natural to me. And in fact, growing up, most dinner conversations revolved around something sexual, so usually with a dose of innuendo and humor. So I was already working with couples and individuals on their interpersonal relationships, and one of my clients knew Julie, who's the head of the digital side of the museum, And so he introduced us, and we instantly hit it off. And then Julie read through some of my writings and asked if I wanted to be a contributing writer, and of course I said yes. But then after I published The Internal Clitoris, I started just receiving tons of emails from women thanking me, but also asking tons of questions, and so then the advice column was born.
I have written about sexuality, and I've been in this field since the 1980s, and I know that many people, when they hear that I do something in the field of sexuality, they kind of titter and they point and they say, oh, you know what she does, and they get silly about it. But it is so needed, and when clients come, they really need to talk about it, and they need to hear, you know, accurate information.
Absolutely. I think that's one of the biggest problems I think that's out there now, is that there's so much misinformation and poor education floating around that people are clueless, unfortunately, when it comes to these things.
And it's even more than that. It's also that nowadays people think they should know, because there's so much out there, there's so much sexuality in the media, so they think they should know already, so they're embarrassed to even say they don't.
It's so true, and especially I think this is very apparent amongst parents and children. You know, parents don't feel comfortable discussing these important topics with their kids, and children wind up getting a lot of their sex ed from watching hardcore pornography. And that's definitely not where we need to be directing our efforts. You know, we need to just be uncomfortable and have the discussion, because the consequences are not good otherwise.
I think that's an important topic, and we'll get back to it. But I would love for you to tell us a little bit about the New York Sex Museum.
So it's really a fun, great place. The Museum of Sex, we call it MoSex, sort of like the MoMA, Museum of Modern Art. So we're MoSex, Museum of Sex.
I like that.
Yeah, it's really fun to say. It's on Fifth Avenue and 27th Street in Manhattan. It was opened in 2002. And the founder and creator is Daniel Gluck, and he really had this vision and wanted to create a museum dedicated to the history, evolution, and cultural significance of human sexuality. So as you can imagine, the exhibits range across the, and they rotate. One exhibit now currently that I really like is called The Universe of Desire, and basically they mined through tons of internet data and searches, basically, you know, what we're clicking on and with what frequency with regards to erotic content, and compiled the top 100 internet searches for erotic content. So when we're confronted with this research, it's extremely compelling to see just how similar and different we all are as humans. And then another exhibit is called The Sex Lives of Animals, which opens
a
whole
a
other layer.
You have a picture
yeah.
of that. I think I put it up on the show.
Yeah, I mean, that exhibit, I think, blows my mind every time I've seen it. I've seen it, you know, tons of times at this point. And it just, The Sex Lives of Animals is way more intensely fascinating than anything we could come up with as humans, I think. The idea that dolphins have blowhole sex and things like this, it's really fun. But I'm just on the digital side of things, really, though, so I'm not at the museum every day. But what's great about having the digital side of the museum is that you don't have to be in New York City to experience the museum. You can really interact from anywhere in the world. And we have a biweekly newsletter called Friends with Benefits, which curates content of what's happening around the globe in the world of sexuality, and also has the advice column in it as well.
What is the name of that again? Friends?
The newsletter is called Friends with Benefits, and you can sign up for it on the museum's website.
Wow. what's interesting to me is that the museum is located on 27th Street and 5th Avenue, and I used to live on 27th and 3rd Avenue, and I taught at the Fashion Institute of Technology on 27th Street and 7th Avenue. So I would have walked by it every day if I was still living there.
Oh, wow. Anyway. Maybe it was your mark of energy on 27th Street.
And I started the human sexuality course at the college. It's true. That's so funny.
Oh, wow. That's so cool.
Anyway.
I have a cousin at FIT now, and it's a great, great school.
Oh, it is. It's creative. It's, you know, really fun, creative place. Beautiful young ladies, mostly. Anyway, I would love you to tell us more about your article now that we're really talking about what's involved in sexuality. You wrote this article about the clitoris, and that's something that nobody talks about.
It's funny you mentioned it's something nobody talks about because when I talked to my grandma about the article and sent it to her, and my father is 73, so he's quite a bit older than my mom, but they both sort of said to me that the word clitoris itself was thought of as sort of vulgar when they were growing up. So it wasn't a word you would just throw around like vagina or penis. It was like a big no-no, which was all new to me because I sort of grew up with, well, yeah, that's part of the body.
I know where it was. I was thinking it was Sex and the City, but it wasn't. It was on Grey's Anatomy, where they labeled it vajayjay.
And it's funny, but I think it is this idea of vocabulary that sort of prevented us from fully exploring and discovering it medically the way that it deserves. So I guess for starters, if you ask most lay people, and maybe even some of the doctors on Grey's Anatomy, if you ask them where the clitoris is, they'll say something like it's the little button up under the hood, or it's the little jelly bean, or the vajayjay, you know, some cute little phrase. But doctors and health professionals have known for quite some time that it's actually a much larger structure, and it's comprised of erectile tissue. But what they didn't know was how that erectile tissue looked and interacted with the rest of female anatomy when it was erect, because we had no way of really seeing what this tissue looked like in its erect state. So in 2009, without any outside funding, two doctors in, of all places, Paris, Dr. Odile Buisson and Dr. Pierre Foltz, gave the world its first sonographic 3D image of an erect internal clitoris. And what we saw may seem unbelievable to some. To me, it all makes sense. And it's a bit difficult to explain. It's a lot easier to see the diagram of it. But without getting into too much medical jargon, the glands of the clitoris is on the outside, and what most people think of when they think of the clitoris is just the tip of the iceberg. The rest of the structure sort of has four legs to it. The two front legs, or bulbs, rest on either side of the vaginal opening, and the two back legs, or crux, basically wrap around the cervix when they become erect. So the long debate of whether or not something is a clitoral orgasm or a vaginal orgasm has now sort of been resolved because, in fact, they're all clitoral orgasms, be they from external stimulation or penetrative stimulation. It's a nice little piece of science that we finally...
What you're saying is it's coming from the same source, but the way someone experiences it in their body might be different in a given situation. I wanted to add something that there are two books that were written, I think, in the 1980s. The G-Spot was Dr. Beverly Whipple, Dr. Alice Lattice, and Dr. John Perry, where they discovered the G-Spot inside the vagina, and that book was, you know, a huge bestseller. Had a huge impact.
Right.
Another book that had a huge impact was Cher Height. Wrote a book, I don't remember the name of the book, but what I remember her saying was she had a lot of statistics in there from her surveys, and a huge number of women were not able to orgasm through intercourse. They did better with touching or with oral sex.
It's true, and it still is true today. So even with media and more knowledge and information and a more sexualized world, the vast majority of women cannot orgasm from penetrative sex. So it's definitely good we have this information now, but it is still a major roadblock for some women, for sure.
And what I've also discovered, recently, a few weeks ago, I interviewed a man, Michael Russer, who had a total prostatectomy, removal of the prostate glands, and he's totally impotent, but he was talking about sexuality and wrote a book about it, that he's had the best sex with his woman, and it has a lot to do with that they're not doing the penetration, so he's spending time and she's enjoying it. And I've heard that from a few other women.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's also a big part of it is that, and especially in a lot of the work I've done with women in their 20s and 30s, they think of sex as this sort of, road trip, and they're sitting there in the car saying, are we there yet? Are we there yet? And all they can think about is this destination of orgasm, and they're not thinking about all the different scenic routes and, to make a metaphor here, and journeys they could be taking, and really just enjoying the ride rather than focusing on getting to orgasm and focusing on getting to climax. And so I think when you start to think of sex as something that's more of a journey and an adventure that you go on with your partner with no destination in mind per se, sometimes where you wind up can be, paradise. So, so I think that's definitely a key factor when you stop putting so much pressure on yourself and your partner and your sex life and you start to enjoy it, it really unfolds and unravels new experiences.
Well, it's not always the woman putting the pressure on herself. A lot of times a male partner will do that. As a matter of fact, even with gay couples, another woman might put pressure on you.
Yeah, it's true. Even with male and female with sex, one call to action I have for women, and with lesbians too, I mean, with everybody, is to stop faking it. That's one of my biggest concerns and something I see a lot of. It's ironic that as women we're sort of trained to cater to this idea of a fragile male ego, and therefore, we fake orgasm and pretend that we've had one because we don't want to make him feel inadequate. And then we end up sacrificing our own needs and our own pleasure, and, we've already sort of developed this lie we're telling in a relationship about that pleasure. So it really does impact and affect a relationship if you're not honest about those things. The sooner you stop faking it through penetrative sex and say, hey, go down on me, then the sooner you can really start enjoying, climaxing together in whichever way you find to be the way to go,
Yeah, so you're saying a few things. One is not to fake it because, for his ego, but a lot of women also fake it because they want to get the man. Maybe he's financially able, or she really likes him or loves him and she wants to win him over. But a relationship is a long-term thing. If it continues and you base it on not telling the truth, eventually it's going to come out. You can't keep faking
Absolutely.
It, or you might avoid sex later on, and it's going to create a problem.
Absolutely. And I think that's another huge inherent problem in the world of relationships and female sexuality is that women are oftentimes using sex to get something that's not their own pleasure. And granted, there are many reasons, and, you know, they're as infinite in complexities and variations as, you know, why we're attracted to other people. But in general, I think if you're having sex to manipulate or maintain a relationship or for other motives rather than your own pleasure, you're probably having sex for the wrong reason. And so that's something I think that needs to be changed, you know, from the way we teach children how to interact and relate to each other, you know, in basic friendships and relationships. If we can sort of change those ideas, then I think it will help girls as they get to be, you know, older to think, well, I don't need to give him my virginity to validate our relationship, or I don't need to have sex with him so he'll put a ring on my finger. You know, I don't need to, I mean, I hope if he puts a ring on your finger, you're having a great sex life, but, you know, it shouldn't be something used for a negotiation tool, for sure.
I think, but a lot of women, I mean, men do these things too, but a lot of women will do it because this pressure from their family and for that pressure to do something causes lots of problems.
Absolutely.
So I'd like to ask you some more. I know that you don't only write about sexuality. You write other articles. So tell us what your favorite articles are about.
You know, well, I guess I really developed the articles from sort of trends I see and what's happening socially and politically and culturally in society, and then also from emails I get. So this one of the things I think is really interesting that I like writing about is just column. I hated the word feminism. It has such a negative connotation to the point where, you know, I was on that bandwagon of women who refused to call myself a feminist and would instead say I'm a humanist, because I grew up in this era when, you know, if you're a feminist, you're an angry, man-hating person and anti-porn and anti-sex, and that's definitely not me. And then I became good friends with the artist behind Clitoracy, Sophia Wallace, and she reminded me that enjoying the right to vote and owning property and having credit automatically makes me a feminist. So I've sort of evolved as a writer with the notion and connotation of this word for it to simply mean equality. So I've written about how I think transgendered people should definitely be included in feminism. I think men should be included in feminism. Men can and should be feminists, because it really does just celebrate equality, all of the uniqueness that is the individual. And at the heart of feminism and equality should be compassion. And so, you know, it is about having compassion and empathy for one another at the end of the day. So that has been something I think in the process of writing for the museum I have changed and developed. And then, of course, I love writing about music because I'm also a professional musician. So anytime there's a song out that everyone's talking about that has sexual undertones, I love sort of exploring and dissecting music. So that's a really fun thing to do as well.
Wow, it's fascinating what you're writing about and thinking about, how you're thinking. So I have a question for you. Do you feel as though the digital world is changing how we view? Two questions. Is the digital world changing our view or our behaviors in sexuality? And what do you feel about pornography? Do you feel like that's damaging? It's connected to the digital world, so that's why I'm asking that.
Yeah. You know, just to put porn on the back burner for a minute, I think the digital world has really broadened our horizons globally. All of a sudden, we have so much information at our fingertips. We can explore and go to Google Earth and visit some island we didn't know. I went to Lanzarote, which is like this Canary Island off the coast of Africa, back in October, And I would have had no idea it existed had I not been playing around on Google Earth. Apparently it's where NASA trains astronauts, so it's a very cool place to visit. So I think the digital world is definitely changing how human connection and how we interact, be it Facebook or Twitter or social media. And then we have things like Match.com and other dating websites, and so we're able to really explore new possibilities and potential connections out there that we may have not been able to, you know, going to the same restaurant, you know, every week or the same yoga class every week. This sort of opens the door to a lot more potential matches. As far as porn, I guess my answer is yes, it is changing our overall collective sexuality and, you know, intimacy with each other, the way we connect. I don't think it's necessarily bad. As far as porn, I think porn is definitely opening our eyes to new proclivities we may have not ever imagined or known before. So, you know, you can go to any site and suddenly there's a plethora of categories from which to choose. But in a sense, I think this exploration of what's out there helps us understand ourselves and also the real variation of sexuality in the sense that we can see how we're all different and we're all the same, which is a beautiful thing. But I think there's also a huge movement out there that demonizes porn, and it all just sort of reminds me of the Prohibition era, complete with treatment centers and support groups. And as I'm sure you know, there's a huge debate in the world of psychology as to whether or not sex addiction and porn addiction are real addictions. And I don't really want to get into that right now, but I will say I think porn is like anything else that's entertainment. It isn't bad when it's used in moderation. And, you know, you can choose your porn the same way you can choose your food. I won't choose to eat McDonald's, and personally I won't choose to watch violent porn. So I think there are, you know, you have to really learn how to use it in a healthy sense. If it's, you know, not something you have to get off, if it's not something that's disrupting or distracting to your relationship or hurtful to your relationship, then I think it's perfectly fine. It's being smart about it, being self-aware, and being really conscious of how it affects you as an individual, and then also the people you have relationships with.
Yeah, it has a huge effect on your relationships, depending on how you use it. That's exactly right, because so many men particularly go on there online and find this porn, and then they're looking at young, beautiful, sexy women and all these different positions and different things, and the person that they're intimate with in the real world may not look like that, may not be open to some of those things, and it can create conflicts. It can create dissatisfaction where it might not have been dissatisfying before.
Absolutely. And, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, that's definitely prevalent and a big issue. But I also think, you know, communication, I think it's funny how people sign prenups before they get married and they talk about what they'll do if, you know, with money, if things go sour. But they never talk about what they would do as far as rules of fighting or who's going to have custody of kids or, you know, how they're going to treat the children. And the other thing that they don't really talk about is what role is sex going to play in their relationship and what role do they want it to play. And this is a part of communication I don't think a lot of couples really discuss initially when they're courting and dating. They're too busy trying to agree on, you know, what restaurant to go to, you know, and it's hard enough to agree on what color to paint the walls, much less have the same sexual fantasies and likes. So, but it is something that I think if we start to incorporate this discussion in dating and relationships sooner, then things like that will creep up less and less moving forward. I definitely think for porn to hit people at this day and age who have already been together for 10 or 15 years and then suddenly they're watching these videos on the internet, that's a lot harder to deal with in a relationship suddenly versus sort of being with somebody where every once in a while you watch a porn video together before you put the iPad or the laptop down and then, you know, finish having fun amongst each other. So I definitely see how it's been a huge negative factor for a lot of relationships, especially people who didn't grow up with it or, you know, it's a new thing to them.
Well, the time is really running out. So if you had one message to share with the baby boomer generation and also with the younger people, what would your message be?
I think for both, the message really is just to talk as much as you can. Be vulnerable and be authentic. For the baby boomers out there, if you have kids or grandkids or nieces or nephews or cousins or any younger people close to you in your life, don't be afraid to discuss topics that might seem uncomfortable. Everyone needs a mentor and an older person with whom to feel trust and confidence in. And I think the baby boomers out there have a wealth of experience that can really collaborate with the waves of change we're seeing now in relationships and sexuality and human connection. And I think that experience is such an invaluable source to ensuring a bright and healthy future for all of us. So, and for the younger people out there, listen to your mentors. And again, don't be afraid to talk about what's uncomfortable because it's so important.
I would add a little piece for the younger people to listen to yourself also.
Yes,
whatever
like that.
You feel, to not negate it, to trust yourself. It was beautiful speaking with you, Ms. M. So how could my listeners get in touch with you?
So you can follow me on Twitter at advice, and that's MSM, like Ms. M. Or I'm on Facebook. It's facebook.com/dearMsM. And then my personal website is advicefrommsm.com. And then, of course, you can find me on the MoSex blog. And just click the blog tab on Museum of Sex's website, and you'll be able to find me there.
Well, I am so happy that we had this opportunity to speak, and I look forward to meeting you at Soho Beach House on February 10th.
Likewise, very excited.
So I am your host, Dr. Erica Goodstone, saying goodbye for now. Please visit my website, healthybabyboomersnetwork.com, to get your free report, How to Live to 100 and Beyond. You can contact me directly at drericagoodstone.com. I look forward to connecting with you again soon.